the Jewish experience of the exile in Bovel was their first experience of Golus, of exile, since what had happened to the Jewish people in Egypt. Golus was a far, Bovel, the exile of Bovel was a far different exile than Egypt. Egypt was slavery. Egypt was blood and hard toil and abuse and atrocities. Bovel, as I think we can characterize it, Bovel was a fairly benign Golus, even though the circumstances by which they came there certainly were sad and tragic. The Jewish kingdom destroyed, the Holy Temple burned, and the Jewish nation dispersed. But once they got to Bovel, once they came to Bovel, and Bovel was a refuge more than an exile. And it always was viewed that way in the history of the Jewish people and in the psychology of the Jewish people. The Jewish community in Bovel, which began approximately in the year 600 before the Common Era, lasted till our day, continuously over 2,500 years. And the flourishing of the Jewish community of Bovel for well over 1,500 years, Bovel was second only to Eretz Yisrael, and that many times was dominant to Eretz Yisrael, and then after the destruction of the Second Temple, it was the Jewish community in the world. And the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, was created there, and the Jewish feelings towards Bovel to a certain extent resembled Jewish feelings towards other warm spots, the few warm spots that we've had in the long exile of the Jewish people. I don't want to compare it exactly to the United States, but to a certain extent it resembles it in terms of the attitude of the government and the freedom that the Jews enjoyed. These are all relative terms. But the effect was an organized Jewish life, that it was a Torah center, that Jews became very wealthy, and that it ended up being so good for Jews that even when Jews had the chance to go back there to Israel, to their own country and their own state, and their own Beis HaMikdash, most of them opted not to do so. So the Talmud tells us, interesting idea, the Talmud tells us in Psochim that God knew that the Jewish people couldn't accept the Golus of Edom as of yet. The Golus of Edom is the second destruction of the temple, which was Rome. And the first destruction was Bovel. So God knew that, so to speak, we were not in shape to accept the rigors of the terrible Golus that Edom would inflict upon us, and therefore he took us to Bovel. And the Talmud gives us many reasons. Bovel had a pleasant climate. It was a valley. Why it was called Bovel was because of one of the reasons Bovel Shinar, named such as that, is because according to the tradition of the Jewish people, the corpses of the people who died in the flood, that was the great rift in the face of the earth. It was the deepest point of the earth, and therefore it was piled high with bodies. And it was like the graveyard of the world. And the climate was good, and then the Talmud says because they spoke Aramaic, which was close to the language of the Jewish people, it was a similar language that the Jews were familiar with. And also it was home, because our father Avraham came from there originally. And therefore the Jews had an affinity towards Bovel, an affinity that they would not have had towards a far stranger or more exotic or different country. And even though we read We read in Tehillim that the Jews wept when they came to Bavel, and when they were requested to sing the song of Zion, so they cut off their thumbs, the Levim, rather than play their harps. They mutilated themselves, and they said, Eich noshir es shir Hashem alad masnechor, how can we sing God's song on foreign soil? To a great extent, that was an initial reaction, because within a generation, the entire Golas Bavel is not a long period of time. It's 70 years at the outside. It's really only 52 years. And so it's within the lifespan of a person. And many things happened. The Babylonian Empire fell and the Persian Empire took it over. And the Jews passed through the miracle of Purim. All of this happened during this period of time. And nevertheless, the Jews took such root in Bavel, and they felt to be so at home there, and they felt it to be such a comfortable place to be, physically and spiritually, that even the great Ezra and Nehemiah were unable to rouse them, were unable to bring them out of Bavel. And there was, and it is quoted a number of times in the Talmud, an opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, that the Jews were not allowed to leave Bavel. Vishom Yiyu, there they shall stay. An echo of an idea that that the Jews had to stay put till God would come and redeem them. They shouldn't go back on them on their own. And even though that was not accepted in halacha, and it was not accepted in the practice, nevertheless it was an idea that was current. And such an idea could gain currency only if there was an hospitable climate. If there was a reason to stay in Bavel. If the Jewish immigration throughout the centuries can easily be traced by what kind of a country they lived in, what kind of a climate they lived in. The Jews in Spain had a memory of having it so good that even when it turned bad, half of them didn't leave. They stayed and converted and somehow thought they would ride out the storm. And whereas in Eastern Europe, when the gates of immigration opened, millions of Jews departed because of the bitterness and the persecution that was involved. So you have here, I think, a clear idea that Chazal give us, that even though the Golas Bavel is not the high point of Jewish history, and being forced to go into exile and under the circumstances that they were, nevertheless, Bavel is not the Golas Bavel is not viewed. It's just not viewed in the same outlook as the Golas of Rome and the Golas that we're in, which has been so replete with murder and constant persecution and uncertainties, etc., with the exception of Purim, which is quite an exception. But with the exception of Purim, the Jews never seem to suffer any great discomfiture or dislocation while they were in Bavel. And that's an important thing, because it explains to us why the Jews were able to build Bavel into such a strong Torah community, into such a center of scholarship, why it became such a strong Jewish center, because of the fact that it had an environment that was conducive for it. Another thing that we see is that the Jews borrowed a lot of things from the Babylonians, even when they came back there to Israel. The names of the Hebrew month, as we have them today, Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, etc., those are all Babylonian names. And it's even strange to notice, I don't know what other word to use, but strange to notice, for instance, the name of one of the months, Tammuz, which is the heat of the summer, was the Babylonian god of fire, whom they burn children to. And it's mentioned in the Tanakh as being a Shem Avodah Zorah, as the name of one of the gods. And yet it became a part of Jewish life to such an extent that in the original, in the first temple, the names of the months were either the number, B'chodesh HaRishon, the first month, the second month, or we have that Tishrei was called Yerach HaEisonim, the month of the Eisonim, of the founders of the Jewish people, and Iyar was called the month of Ziv, because of the beauty of nature during that month of springtime. But all of those names were forgotten, or they were, if not forgotten, they were consigned to not being used. Whereas the Babylonian names that the Jews had brought back with them became the basis of the Jewish calendar and became the names of the month that we have till today. There are other influences, strong Babylonian influences upon Jewish life. The language in the time of the Second Temple, the language of Aramaic was the prevalent language. Even though they all knew Hebrew and they spoke Hebrew and the official documents were in Hebrew and the Mishnah was composed in Hebrew, the language was Aramaic. The lingua franca that people spoke, that was Aramaic. And that was a direct relationship to their time in Bavel as well. And clear customs and viewpoints of the Babylonians made their way into Jewish life. The Jews have the Jewish people have a knack of taking and borrowing things from other nations and Judaizing it. And by so doing, they have made it Jewish. To an extent that per the original nation, even if it does recognize it, probably no longer claims it. We've always done that with languages. Yiddish is the example of the Ashkenazic Jews who borrowed German, a dialect of German. Ladino is an example of the Sephardic Jews who borrowed a Spanish dialect, Turkish dialect. The Jews borrowed from the Arabs wherever they went, because being the minority culture, one was always affected by what the majority culture did. But the Jews were able to absorb it in such a way as to make it Jewish. And that process begins here in Bavel, where we see the Jews adopted many, many things, and nevertheless made the Babylonian Jewish instead of the Jewish Babylonian. The rabbis held Bavel in such high esteem that they said that just as it is forbidden to leave Eretz Yisrael to go to Bavel, one is not permitted to leave Eretz Yisrael. So they said one is not permitted to leave Bavel to go to other countries in the diaspora. In other words, Bavel was not equal to Turkey or Asia Minor or any of the other places in the world. Bavel had a special place, a special holiness. And all of that is because of the fact that the Jewish infrastructure was so strong and the Jews were able to prosper. The Novi Yecheskel was there in Bavel. The great men of the Sanhedrin, of the previous Sanhedrin, were there in Bavel. The yeshivas were there. The synagogues were built. And within a decade after the arrival of the Jews in Bavel, the Jews were a main force, and they were very well established, and they were very comfortable, and they had a very strong religious life. The king Tzidkio himself, the king Yehoiachin himself, was released from prison and was treated as a royal guest rather than a hostage, and Jews rose rapidly, as Jews almost always do. They rose very rapidly in the society and in the government. The rabbis therefore said They went so far as to say that he who lives in Bovel is as though he lives in Eretz Yisrael, an opinion of the rabbis and ksubas, which I'm certain today we would amend to read Borough Park or Williamsburg or Muncie. But it was that kind of an idea, it was that kind of a viewpoint. And the rabbis also said that one who lives in Bovel will be spared the Chevle Moshiach, will be spared the pain and the pangs of the coming of the Messiah. Now, all of these are examples, and there are only a few examples out of very many that can be brought, of the very positive attitude that the rabbis had and that the Jewish people had towards Bovel. If you contrast it with the things that are said regarding Rome, like Rome is never mentioned in the Talmud almost without an epitaph, without epithet, without a cross word being said, a Malchus or Rishor, the evil kingdom. Rome, and in terms of civilization, Rome was much more than Bovel. And Rome contributed more, and it was a greater society, but the Jews had nothing to say about Rome that was positive. And even when Rome was complimented in the Talmud, look at the bridges they built, look at the roads they built, look at the government, so the Jewish answer was that they only did it for themselves. They did it to raise the taxes, it's like the New York Thruway. They only do it to raise the tolls. They're not interested in the altruistic public service. The rabbis could not bring themselves to say a good word about Rome, and the Jewish people couldn't. But Bovel, they almost lavished praise upon it, and that's a startling contrast in the two exiles. The Gemara says, as I mentioned before, that the Seftim Baba Kama says that since our father Abraham came from Bovel, the Jews felt at home. Meaning, that's part of it. The Babylonians were second cousins, third cousins. In our terrible dispute with the Arabs, our neighbors and cousins, there nevertheless is some strange affinity. Some strange relationship, as though we both understand each other, even though we both may despise each other, which would not be true if, for instance, we were dealing with the Vietnamese or the Japanese or someone that really has no relationship, no blood relationship whatsoever with us. So the fact that that was Abraham's house and that these people in a far distant past came from a common ancestor, so that counted also for something, and it removed some of the strangeness. I think also, as I mentioned before, the topography of the land, the climate, Bovel is not that much different than Eretz Yisrael. It's not somebody from the Middle East being exiled to the Western Hemisphere or to a cold climate or to a tropical Pacific island that requires an enormous adjustment. But Bovel is really a neighbor. Unfortunately, today it's too close a neighbor, but it really is a neighbor. And therefore, it had a familiarity with it. And I don't want to dwell on this point too long, but I just want to mention how far it went, which is the Yerushalmi and the Dorim says a paraphrase. And if the Yerushalmi wouldn't say it, no one would dare say it. But it gives you an idea of what they thought of Bovel, and I think, again, it's an insight into what a lot of American Jews think about America. You all know the famous pasuk in the Novi, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Sora Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. So the Talmud paraphrased it and said, Ki Mi Bovel Teitzei Torah Udvar Hashem Menahar Pekod, that from Bovel will come forth the Torah and the Word of God from Nahar Pekod, whether it means the river or whether that was the name of a city that was famous for its yeshivas. There are different interpretations. But the rabbis went so far, they didn't consider it sacrilegious. I mean, today, even in the most extreme of of viewpoints, and no one would yet say, you know, America, Tetzei Torah, you know, Dvar Hashem from Brooklyn or Muncie. That still would be considered to be sacrilegious. That still would, that would be saying too much. Suffering, but not Muncie. But the Yerushalmi quotes it. The Yerushalmi quotes it, and the Yerushalmi does not quote it in jest, and it's not a, and they don't quote it as, look how bad they were that they said it, or they don't quote it sarcastically. And therefore, that's a revealing state of mind. It's a revealing insight into how into what the Jews thought about the exile in Bavel, what the Jews thought about their future in Bavel. All of this goes to explain the historical phenomena that when they, as I'll discuss with you in a few moments, when the Jews had the chance to go back, they did not go back. There's no question that if Russia even today would open its doors so 500,000 Jews would leave, some say 1,000,000 Jews would leave, and they would just leave. And other places in the world, Jews would leave. But in the free countries in the world where Jews can leave, that's the paradox. They don't leave simply because they do exist in free countries and they do have the benefits of that society, and therefore there's no compulsion to push them. The rabbis, again, so that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is that it's an exile. That it still wasn't home, and it still was an exile. I think I've mentioned it to you once before, but I remember that I, for a period of time, I studied with a very fine, great Rav, a Chassidic Rav, who used to visit Miami Beach in the winter. And so we had a learning session every day for an hour and a half or 2 hours in the morning. So he would sit out in my backyard under the avocado tree, you know, in shirt sleeves in the middle of December. And we would learn together. So he once told me, he says, if you have to be in Golis, he said, Miami Beach is not that bad of a Golis. This was the attitude towards Bavel, but the rabbis wanted to remind us that Bavel still was a Golis. So therefore, they said b'machashaki moshivani, that the Rabbeinu Shalom placed me in darkness. Zeh Talmudo shel Bavel. That's the Babylonian Talmud. That's Bavel. Under the best of circumstances, Bavel is still darkness. The Talmud says, Lev Ragoz, that they had an emotional, insecure feeling about themselves. That's even in the great security of Bavel. The exile breeds insecurity. So in Bavel, they were strangers, even though they weren't strangers. And that's a point that has to be emphasized. In fact, the Gemara emphasized it in such a way that they said that the Gemara Menachos says on the Pasuk, Eviu Bonai Meirochok, bring my children from afar. So the rabbi said, those are the Jews that live in Bavel. Shadaitam Yusheves Aleim. They are comfortable. They're not driven. So the Novi says that at the time of the Mashiach will have to bring them. They'll have to come from far. So the definition of far is not far in terms of geography, because Bavel was very close in terms of geography. But far is a psychological distance. Person who feels comfortable, Daito Miyushavolov, his mind is always at ease, he's planning for the future, he sees generations, he doesn't see that anything is ever going to change. So that's, you have to bring him from afar, because psychologically he's not prepared to return. Psychologically he's not willing or able to deal with Eretz Yisrael, because why should he? He's in good shape in Bavel. All of that goes to it. Our rabbis tell us that the Novi Yirmio was brought to the by his captors, was brought to the gates of Bavel, to the frontier of Bavel, and there he was freed by his captors and told that he could go wherever he wanted to. And Yirmio turned around and went back there to Israel. And he did not stay with the flock in Bavel. The Talmud tells us that when he came to the Euphrates, he turned around and he said he's going back because there still were a number of Jews left in Eretz Yisrael, the story of Gedaliah that I discussed with you. And there still was a hope that there could perhaps be some autonomous rule for the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. So Yirmio returned to try and strengthen them. And the Jews from Bavel wept, and they shouted, Rabbeinu Yirmio, Hare Atom Anichonu, Yirmio, you're deserting us. How can you go back? Stay with us. And he answered them one of the most cryptic, bitter answers. He said, now you cry. He said, in all the years that I spoke to you in Eretz Yisrael, if you would have cried once, we never would have come to this situation. And now in the Golis, all of a sudden, you know, how can we be without Yirmio? But in Eretz Yisrael, they were willing to put Yirmio in the prison, in the dungeon. They were willing to ignore him. No one wept when said, Yirmio, you're leaving us. And, you know, who needs him? And Yirmio did return. But part of the insight here is that Yirmio felt that in Eretz Yisrael he was needed. In Bavel, to a certain extent, so to speak, he was superfluous. Because Yechezkel was in Bavel, as I mentioned to you, the Sanhedrin was in Bavel, Jewish life was in Bavel already. So if Jewish life was in Bavel, so he didn't feel that he would make the difference. Whereas in Eretz Yisrael, he felt that he could save the remnant that was there under Gedaliah, and that was his hope, which turned out to be fruitless because Gedaliah was assassinated, and Yirmio eventually had to flee to Egypt with the rest of the Jewish inhabitants of the country. The reign of Nebuchadnezzar did not last long. It was another 18 years. He died, and his son came to power, and then his grandson came to power. And almost unbeknownst to them, it's very hard to imagine such a thing, but it has happened many times in the history of the world. A new empire arises, a completely new empire, to the east of Bavel, and the Babylonians were unaware, and if they were unaware, they did not read it correctly, what was going to happen here. Because under we could understand that since Nebuchadnezzar ruled the entire world, he became complacent. There's, what do they say, that the Super Bowl champion never repeats? It's very hard. The worst thing about being number one is that you're number one. And he was not aware of the fact that his kingdom was doomed, his empire was doomed. Having achieved it, much in the same way as Alexander and later the Romans, having achieved world dominion, he was destined to lose it. The only thing, he lost it very quickly, and they lost it, practically speaking, overnight. And they lost it to this force from the east, which came from Afghanistan and Persia. We see that the geography of the situation is the same today, and really the contending ethnic forces are the same. You read the Afghans and the Kurds and the Persians and the Medes, and those are all the same characters. We have come quite a few centuries since then, but very little else has changed. And the conflict that arose was occasioned by the fact that these two great tribes, the Persians and the Medes, were able to unite. Individually, Bavel could have withstood either of them. But collectively, they were stronger than Bovel, and Bovel did not realize that. And the Persians brought with them not only a fierce determination to rule the world, but they brought with them great skills, and they sensed correctly that the Babylonia was a paper tiger, that the Babylonians had gone soft, so to speak. They were not any longer capable of defending themselves. And the Navi sees it as the retribution on Bovel for its destruction of Eretz Yisrael, that eventually the world turns. Eventually, the Ribbono Shel Olam in history collects all scores. And therefore, it could not be that that Bovel would escape unscathed for what it had done. And in the famous scene described in the Book of Daniel, the king Belshazzar is at a banquet. He's not even at war. He's at a banquet and he sees written on the wall in the handwriting and the finger that writes that Mene Mene Tekele Farsin. And he is astounded, frightened, and the Navi interprets it for him as meaning that his doom at the hands of the Persians is here. He's been weighed in the scales of history and found wanting. Now that's a great imagery that's used in the Tanakh and used in the Talmud also, is that until a country or a person rises to greatness, you know, in heaven they let them alone. It's one of the dangers of running for president of the United States. We see that, right? If our vice president, whatever, if Senator Quayle would have remained the senator from Indiana, no one would have cared. But if you want to run for vice president, so then they have a right to look over, you know, they have to see how many times you came late to the minyan. All of everything in a person's life now is in the balance scale. Now it's to be measured. And therefore, an insignificant event all of a sudden takes on an importance that's almost outlandish. But that's the way it is. So we understand that now. We may not agree with it, but we understand that those are the rules of the game. That's the way the world works. Well, Chazal saw that regarding history as well. If you remain a second-rate country, you don't aspire to greatness, you're not going to be the world empire, you don't want to be the chief emperor in the world, all right, so they don't, so to speak, they don't pull your file in heaven. They are not that concerned with you. How can we phrase it that forces of natural history are allowed to continue in their own slow pace, always under divine guidance, but the moment you become it, you rise to the top, so then all of a sudden abnormal things happen to you. It's not, the measurement is different. And that's what happened to Bovel. Bovel, having assumed its role of greatness, is thrust into the limelight and then it's thrown off its pedestal in a very short period of time. And the Persians, the Medes, sweep in. Now the Jews, even though they liked Bovel, liked the Persians, the Medes even better. And a number of reasons for that. One reason is because of the fact that they felt good over the fact that the Babylonians got theirs, that the Babylonians were punished. And they also felt that under the Persians, who were strangers, that they would have a better shot because they also were strangers. And that the Persians would not use the Babylonian infrastructure because the Babylonians were their enemies, were the people they defeated, and therefore the Jews had a chance. And in reality, not only did the Jews have a chance, but that's exactly what happened. The Jews rose in a very short period of time to very high rank and prominence. Now, in the book of Daniel, we are told that Nebuchadnezzar himself took Jewish young men and trained them for the Babylonian civil service so that they became the leaders or the chief men in his court. Foremost among them, we read the story of Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, who was a megalomaniac, because you cannot be emperor of the world unless you have a little of that in you, he wanted that the whole world should bow to him. And in a society of paganism, in a society where people bow to idols, so he wanted to enforce his religion and his honor. And he did so at the pain of death. Religions throughout the history of the world that have controlled the lives of other people have found it easy to gain adherence, because the choice that was given was always a simple one. Either you convert to us or you die. With the exception of the Jews and a number of other exceptions in the world, most people, what did Henry of Navarre said? He said that Paris is worth a mass. He was a Protestant, and they made a deal with him that if he would become a Roman Catholic, he would become the King of France. So he said in one of the most cynical real politic statements in the history of the world, he said, Paris is worth a mass. So most of the world feels that way, right? So, and Nebuchadnezzar was able, therefore, to impose upon his society this belief in himself. Whether they believed it or not made no difference, but at least public worship of himself and public worship of his gods. And Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and Daniel were the only ones that resisted. And the problem with resistance is that you have to put it down. If you let it remain, so then eventually, even though it's only 4 people, 10 million people are bowing down to you, and 4 people aren't, so you'll say, well, what's the difference? You know, you got the 10 million, who cares about the 4? Well, first of all, in the mindset of a megalomaniac, the 4 are, he's paranoid about the 4. And secondly, he has reason to be, because the 4... The 4 will spread enough insidious poison by just not bowing down that the 10 million will soon melt away also. And therefore he took upon himself the task of destroying these 4. And since they were in his complete control, so he could do so. So he threw Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah into the furnace of fire. By the way, we read in the Tanakh that they had Babylonian names. Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, and they were high officials in the Babylonian government. So he took them and he threw them in a furnace of fire, and they were protected. The angel came down, and they were protected in the furnace. And the furnace was so hot that the executioners and the guards that were around the furnace were burned to death from the heat of it. And they who were in the furnace were saved. It's interesting how the Tanakh points out to us, as always happens, that Nebuchadnezzar said, gee, that's a good trick, those are good guys, you know, but it didn't change him. He sent, he made a commission to study the matter and to, I'm sure it got written up in the science edition of the Times on Tuesdays, but otherwise it made no impression. Zero. And then later on, when Daniel also refused to convert So he threw Daniel into the lion's den, which these were forms of certain death. And there also Daniel is protected, and he's saved, and he is taken forth from the pit. And it's remarkable is that it made no impression, which is part of the message that the Tanakh and that Chazal always bring to us, is that supernatural events don't make an impression. They are a temporary newsworthy item, but they don't really change people's minds. You have to work hard, and there has to be a different approach to change someone's mind, to change someone's heart. When I discussed the Novi Eliyahu with you, so the great miracle on Har HaCarmel, so it says, Vayar kol ha'om vayiplu al pneim, the Jewish people saw, everyone saw, and they fell on their face, Vayomu Hashem hu Elokim, Hashem hu Elokim. The Lord is God, the Lord is God. And what can be greater than that? We say that to seal the holy day of Yom HaKippurim, to end it, to say that phrase. So what happened to him all the next day? The next day he couldn't get a minyan for Mincha. Here is, Hashem hu Elokim. The answer is that miracles and external phenomena and all of the supernatural things in the world, great and moving as it is, don't do it. Our rabbis pointed out that the Jewish people walked through the Red Sea. That didn't stop them from making an eagle. And the moon falls every day. You name it, whatever miracle. So we have a feeling that's not like that. We have a feeling that if somehow we would see miracles on a regular basis, there wouldn't be any problems in Judaism. Everything would be solved. But everything in Jewish history and everything in the Tanakh and the Talmud speaks against that naive notion. It would be nice to have it. We would appreciate a miracle every so often. And, it could have a very salutary effect upon our lives and our status. But that isn't what weighs in the balance scale. It really isn't what makes it. And therefore, these experiences of Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and the experiences of Daniel, impressive as they are, did not change anything. And not only that, they didn't make the Jewish people any better. Our rabbis tell us in one of the strongest statements that they make is that in the Babylonian exile, the rate of assimilation began to take its toll, because as I described to you, Bovel was a good place, a nice place. When the Jews are in comfortable surroundings, that's when assimilation occurs. The real gauge of assimilation is not the Jews, it's the attitude of the non-Jewish world towards the Jews. And when there is a benign attitude, then there must be assimilation, then it becomes very, very difficult to fight against it. When the non-Jewish world locks the Jews up in the ghetto and does not allow them any rights or any economic hope, so then there's nothing to assimilate to. So our rabbis say, what happened to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? Imagine, three great people who were thrown in the furnace of fire and were saved in front of a multitude of hundreds of thousands of onlookers, right? Sunday afternoon at Yankee Stadium. And everybody saw it, and Nebuchadnezzar himself sees it. And so what happened to them? Our rabbis say a very strange thing. They say, Tovu Baroque. They drowned in spittle. The Goyim spat at them. They drowned in spit. Because the Goyim said, Eloheim Shalelu. You know that you have such a God that he does things like that for you, and you have forsaken him, and you don't observe his Torah. So the ridicule, so just the opposite occurred, that because of the miracle, because of the salvation, that brought about a reaction of shame within the Jewish people. It brought about a reaction of ridicule from the non-Jewish world. That what kind of people are these? If they have such a religion, and they have such a God, and they have such a faith, and that such miraculous things can happen to them over and over again, and yet we see how they assimilate. And yet we see that they are in a headlong flight not to be Jewish. So our rabbis characterize it in a phrase that is memorable to us, that's graphic, that we'll understand what they mean. So they say, Tovu Baroch, drowned in spit, drowned in derision. And therefore, the Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were really not usable for the rest of their lives. Because instead of being the representative of the triumph of the Jewish people and the triumph of the Rabboni Shel Olam, they came to be seen in the world and amongst Jews themselves as the representatives of the ignominy of the Jewish people, of the weakness of the Jewish people, of the fact that Jewish people don't have an appreciation of what they are and who they are and what they should be. In the long history of the Jewish people, we have many, many such incidents where great things have happened to the Jewish people, and because of that, shame arises. The world is hard put to understand why the Jews behave as they behave. Now, aside, one of the things the Talmud tells us is that, for instance, during the time of they refused to eat the non-kosher food or the bread that was baked in the king's palace, even though they were courtiers. So you see that the Babylonian government began to make concessions in order to have the Jews in their service and in their employ, something which, again, is not unknown. But again, it's a strange world, how the world works. I was on a cruise ship to Alaska, and I got up 4 in the morning to go out on deck and daven. It's light there all the time. There's no darkness. And we were passing through a particularly beautiful place, and nobody else was on deck. And I was down there, my towels and tefillin on, and then I noticed it's an English boat, so all the officers are English. And the dining room and the kitchen are all Italians, and the guys that do the work are all Pakistanis. So I noticed the head Pakistani, he was up and he was watching me. So he came over to me afterwards and he asked me if I was Muslim. So I told him, no, I'm not Muslim, I'm Jewish. And he went off as Israeli. We got the whole conversation. But one of the things that he told me that's fascinating is that on this boat they have a special kitchen for the Muslims. They get all their help from one town in Pakistan. They've had for 137 years a contract with this village, and they provide them with the bodies that they need. They're the guys that paint and the stokers in the engine room, and they do the cleaners. And they have this contract with this village, and each guy has a contract for 2.5 years. In 2.5 years, he saves up enough money. He never has to, if he goes back to the village, he never has to work again. But he said it's hard to keep them bound on the village after they're out for 2.5 years, so then they never have the money. But in any event, see, you explained to me they have their own kitchen, and the Muslims, and they wouldn't eat the English food, they wouldn't eat with the Italians, they wouldn't eat anything with the others, etc. And you got a boat there. So originally when you're on the boat, you think there are no Jews. But by the end of the boat ride, especially if you're the only guy wearing a yarmulke, and they all come over to you after a while, so you can find out there must have been 150 Jews on the boat. So I thought to myself, I mean, these Pakistani illiterates, right? So they got their own kitchen. They don't care. And the 150 Jews who are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and who are the sophisticated and intellectual and intelligent people, you know, it's the Mechas V'Sholem, they're all eating the shrimp that the Italian guys are making for them. So it's a it's a source of derision, source of shame. And that's what happened to the Jews in Bovel. In Bovel, we have the first occurrence, really, of that the assimilation was there. And in order to stop the assimilation, that's how the rabbis saw the story of Purim. And they saw the Persians and Medes to come and put the brake on it. because when the Persians and Medes came, so there were a number of immediate revolutions, one after the other, coup d'etats between the generals themselves until Ahasuerus reaches office. So again, you have high-ranking Jews that were in the Persian hierarchy. According to one shot in the Medrash, Daniel himself was one of the leading courtiers in the court of Ahasuerus. But there were Jews, and not only were there Jews, Ahasuerus made a banquet in which he served, glat kosher food. The only thing is, he brought out the kelim at the Beis HaMikdash. He wanted to display all of his wealth. That's why we read the pasuk v'chelim mikelim shonim, that he had different types of utensils. So that verse in the Megillah is read to the melody of Eicha, is because it refers to the fact that he had on display from the Beis HaMikdash, captured utensils. So the rabbi said, how could Jews go to a party that's displaying the captured utensils of the Beis HaMikdash, to go to this drunken king's party and with all the behavior that went on, etc.? So what if he had kosher food? But that's, again, an indication of what happened to the Jews in Bavel in a very short period of time. The acculturation, the assimilation, the viewpoint that came into them. And in order to correct that, so they got one stiff, good shock, which is the story of Purim, the story of Haman, in which for unreasoning, irrational anti-Semitism, counterproductive, and he's willing to give 10,000 talents of silver to destroy the Jewish people. And he almost gets away with it. It would not have been for all of the strange circumstances which combined to make the hidden nest of Purim, he would have gotten away with it, and nobody would have said anything. And they passed the law, everybody is to be killed and goodbye. And the law never could be revoked. So the Ness of Purim is what shocked the Jewish people back into the reality. It served as a break on the assimilatory tide. And that's why it says in the Megillah, Kimu v'kiblu ayehudim aleihem, the Jewish people accepted once again the Torah. So our rabbis teach us that the first time that we accepted the Torah, which was at Sinai, so that was conditional. First of all, we were forced into it. The revelation was so great that the Jews couldn't say no. Even if they wanted to say no, they couldn't have said no. And secondly, it was conditional upon the land of Israel. Right? You keep the Torah, I'll give you the land of Israel. It was a quid pro quo. Now that they were driven out of the land of Israel, the Rashba says so, and other commentators say, now that they were driven out, so to speak, the contract was over. Contract had ended. They had no responsibilities. Could have been whatever they wanted to. But God did not want the contract to end. And the story of Purim came as the reminder of the eternity of the covenant. Ele divrei abris. These are the words of the covenant that the Ribbono Shel Olam made with the Jewish people on Sinai. Those words and that covenant is eternal. And we cannot escape it, and Kaviyochel, he also cannot escape it. It's non-cancelable. And Purim came to do that. So then, Kimu v'kiblu ayehudim aleihem, now the second time we accepted it, no conditions. We accepted it. Well, it doesn't make any difference what happens with us in Eretz Yisrael. Nothing makes a difference. We're in it now for the long haul. And that's one of the reasons why Purim has, besides the festive atmosphere which we see on the outside, Purim is seen as one of the most meaningful commemorations which exists in all of Jewish life and all of Jewish history. In fact, our rabbis say that the holy day of Yom Kippur is Yom Kippurim, a day like Purim. Purim is the flip side, so to speak, of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is without food and Purim is with food, but it's the same idea. It's the attestation to the unending covenant that exists between God and Israel and between each and every Jew, and how therefore we have to respond to it. In the middle of this whole turmoil, therefore, the Jewish people received permission to return to the land of Israel. It's not exactly clear the dates. We have a problem. I discussed that in one of the tapes regarding the Second Commonwealth, how it happened, when it happened. But what happened was that one of the Persian emperors, Koresh, gave the Jews, the agreement of its time, the Balfour Declaration, the partition agreement, whatever word you want to use, it said that the Jews have a right to return. And a very small number of Jews returned, and then there was a second return with a larger number of Jews, though relatively speaking still a small amount, under Ezra and Nehemiah, and the Jews began to rebuild Eretz Israel. The Jews in Babylonia supported them. They supported them with wealth. They supported them with efforts. They supported them with political influence. They did everything possible to make certain that the burgeoning little colony would grow. But they did not support them in numbers. They did not come themselves. And they remained in Bovel, and Bovel remained the home of the Jewish people, the central home of the Jewish people. And in fact, one could say that Bovel and Eretz Yisrael were in competition for 600 years as to which was the center of Jewish life. And we find great scholars that traveled between them. And there were great schools and great communities in both places. But after the destruction of the Second Temple, then Bovel was like the only place left. And Bovel regained its ascendancy and remained so until the time that the Jews came to Morocco and to Spain. So we see that that first exile into Bovel set certain patterns into motion, established certain guidelines as to how Jewish history would function, how the Jewish people would act in exile. And that to a great extent, those patterns and guidelines have held true throughout the ages. And that they can be seen even in our time, even in our exile here, as still functioning in many, many uncanny parallel ways. And because of that, therefore, Bovel always took on that great importance in Jewish life. I think I saw it somewhere, but I have since thought about it a number of times, and I feel it to be innately correct, that that's one of the reasons that we preserved prayers that were said exclusively for the Babylonian exile, such as the two Yikum Purkans, which we recite on Shabbos after Kriyas HaTorah, which have absolutely no relevance to us. And, you know, you're praying for the judges in Bovel in the 5th and 6th centuries. Well, what's it got to do with me in Rockland County, New York, at the end of the 20th century? And it's not in Hebrew, it's in Aramaic. But the wisdom of the Jewish people, which is found in our Siddur and in the customs of the Jewish people, preserved it because of the fact that they wanted us to remember that Bovel is still here. They wanted us to remember that there were judges, and there was a Reish Galusa, there was a prince, and there was a Jewish autonomy. Everything existed for the Jews in Bovel. And that's the nature of the exile, that sometimes Jews can live that way for long periods of time, but that Jews should never forget the fact that it's still exile. And now it's not here. Now it's a non sequitur. It has absolutely no relevance or relationship to our lives, except in the fact that it reminds us about Bovel. It reminds us of the language that the Jews spoke and of the places where they lived and of the officers and institutions that they had. All of that becomes part and parcel of us. And these prayers are a means of relating us, so to speak, back to Bovel, of tying the chain even tighter and are making us realize where we have been so that we're able to assess better the situation that we find ourselves in, and hopefully also to be able, therefore, to see where we're going as well.